The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
What happened after Costa Rica abolished its military?
After Costa Rica abolished its military, the government started to put money into putting land away. And in fact, Costa Rica has about 25% of their land put away for conservation. And so that's what makes Costa Rica one of the most ecologically advanced countries in the world.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with world traveler and writer Marty Essen about his book titled Endangered Edens, Exploring the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Costa Rica, the Everglades, and Puerto Rico. Let's find out what is in this book just by hearing you read the introduction.
Okay, this book contains four chapters sequenced in the order the events occurred. Although I hope you'll read Endangered Edens from cover to cover, each chapter stands on its own. If you picked up this book because a particular chapter interested you, feel free to start with that chapter and return to others afterwards. I chose to call this book Endangered Edens because each chapter features an adventure in a paradisical location that faces an uncertain future because of human activities. However, each of the four locations is in a different stage of endangerment. Chapter 1, Puerto Rico Herpin, or I thought this was a girl trip. The island of Puerto Rico covers 3,515 square miles, but it has a population of roughly 3.6 million people. Add to that all the tourists that visit each year, and one can easily understand why Puerto Rico is an endangered Eden. Fortunately, most people congregate in the cities. And as you'll see when you read about Deb's and my adventure, we found some great natural places away from the human beehives. The second chapter is Arctic Eyewitness. Without a doubt, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge's coastal plain is the most fought-over piece of land in the United States. The fight isn't between armed combatants, however. It's between the Democrats and their environmentalist allies and the Republicans and their oil company allies. So far, conservation has prevailed over exploitation, but as long as we have a political system that allows corporations to buy influence, the Arctic coastal plain will always be at the mercy of the next election. As you'll see when you read about Deb's and my adventure, the Arctic coastal plain is an endangered Eden worth way more than anything an oil company or an oil company-controlled politician can ever give us. The third chapter is called I Got Cottonmouth with Two Russians in the Everglades, but I swear I didn't inhale. The Everglades is an endangered Eden in a lull between major endangerments. Not too long ago, alligators, great egrets, and other Everglades species were on the brink of extinction. Through conservation efforts, many of those species have made impressive comebacks. That's wonderful. However, many of those same species will become endangered again as climate change worsens and ocean levels rise, flooding their freshwater habitat with saltwater. As you'll see when you read about my solo adventure, the Everglades is an endangered Eden where people can find solitude and enjoy a wide variety of close-up bird and reptile encounters. And the final chapter is called Bat an Eyelash and Monkey Around in Costa Rica. Costa Rica is by far the least endangered Eden in this book. The reason is because Costa Rica has one of the most environmentally enlightened governments in the world, and that government has worked to protect the country's future by setting aside roughly 25% of its land for conservation. Even so, Costa Rica will never be able to isolate itself from outside influences such as climate change and the black market for animal products. As you'll see, Costa Rica may be as close to a paradise as you will find on our endangered planet. Okay, it's time to put on your virtual hiking boots. Let's head out on an adventure.
In your previous book, you wrote about visiting places on all seven continents. So this is smaller in scope, but you've gone to these places to photograph animals, and you found some very strange ones, and we'll talk about those in a minute. But first, explain how the Puerto Rico trip happened.
Well, my wife and I, we had, as you just mentioned, we had traveled all seven continents looking for rare and interesting wildlife, and that became my first book, Cool Creatures, Hot Planet, Exploring the Seven Continents. And after that, you know, we were really exhausted after doing all of that and writing the book. And I wasn't even thinking about a book chapter at that time. My wife just wanted to get away from it all. And as I joke about it in the book, she wanted to go on a girl trip, you know, with the time on the beach and where we actually have bathrooms that have flush toilets. And so she wanted to go to Puerto Rico. And I wasn't really excited about Puerto Rico because it is an overpopulated island. But I started doing some research to see, well, maybe there's something at Puerto Rico that I would be interested in as well. And, you know, I love all animals, but I have this soft spot in my heart for snakes. And I think the reason for that is not many people do have a soft spot in their heart for snakes, and snakes need someone to stick up for them. So I did some research and learned that there were Puerto Rican boas that hung out in caves. And what's unique about these boas, and they're a big snake about 6 feet long, and they will hold on to the rock face with their tails at cave entrances. And as the bats at night fly out, the Puerto Rican boas will basically strike out and grab the bats in midair and then eat the bats right while they're holding on to the side of the cave. And so I did an internet search and found a man who was doing some research for a university who lived in Puerto Rico, and we exchanged emails, and he offered to take me to that cave. So once I knew we could go to this cave and see these Puerto Rican boas, I was on the trip and excited to go.
And you took some photographs of those boas, and not without mishap, though. Tell us what happened.
Well, unfortunately, where we went to see the snakes, and I'll kind of explain how this we have to go through this gate because it's gated, and then you have to hike in about a mile, and they keep it gated so that people, you know, that won't go and damage the ecosystem there. And as we're hiking in, pouring rain starts coming down. And so we get to the cave, and it's not like a cave that goes straight into the side of a mountain. What it does is it drops down into this big oval pit and probably drops down about 20 or 30 feet. And then off to the side, on one of the walls of the pit, that's where it goes into the cave. And so the tricky part was trying to get down a little bit closer to get a good photo in the rain, and to try to get the photos. And there's one time I slipped and skinned my knee, and of course you're getting bat guano all over yourself as it happened. And so it wasn't a clean and pretty photo shoot, but I got some great photos. It was really a great experience to see all this happen. I had to do a little bit in Photoshop sometimes to get the photos right for the book, because there'd be water on the lenses, but we were able to take care of that, and it turned out pretty darn good.
Yeah, all the images in the book are beautiful.
Thank you.
And it's a photograph book. It's on heavy paper stock.
Yeah, you know, when my first book came out, it had about 80 photos in it, but they were fairly small, and we just did it as an insert. And when people review my books, I read every single review. And my first book got great reviews, but there'd always be this one little sentence that would say, he should have had more photos. And so I decided for this book to kind of merge genres and do not quite a coffee table book, but kind of, you know, a book with coffee table book quality photos on the heavy paper. But then I also made the book a little bit lighter so that you can actually hold it and read it, because there are a lot of great and funny stories and adventures in the book. So kind of merging the genres of a travelogue, an environmental education book, and a coffee table book.
You succeeded.
Thank you.
One of the animals I'd never heard of was a skink.
Yes, skink is just a type of lizard. And You know, they're famous for losing their tails. You find skinks a lot without a tail because the tail will break off, and that's one of the animal's escape mechanisms.
One of your most important discoveries in Puerto Rico had nothing to do with animals. It was about the rum.
Yeah. Now, I do need to say that this Puerto Rico trip happened in 2006. So things were a little bit different in airports in 2006. And as we were in Puerto Rico, of course, we sampled lots of different types of Puerto Rican rum and found our favorite. In fact, as one of the bartenders at one of the bars we stopped at to sample the rum said, we don't export the good stuff. So we got the good stuff and we bought it in at the airport, and they sealed it up and said, oh, no problem taking it back on the plane because it's sealed. It's got the official seal on it. Well, when we got back to the Newark airport, even though Puerto Rico isn't a foreign country, it's a U.S. territory, as far as the airports are concerned, they treat it as a foreign country. And so we had to go through security again, and they grabbed our Puerto Rican rum. So we lost all our good Puerto Rican rum on the way home. I'm sure it didn't get thrown down the garbage. You know, as I say in my book, I hope that the TSA agents got a really bad hangover.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Marty Essen about his book, Endangered Edens. If you'd like to listen again or share this program with a friend, it's available as a podcast and at our blog. Links to both are at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. We'll be right back to talk about the difference between the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and Prudhoe Bay. Stay with us. In Chapter 2, you and Deb traveled through the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and then up to Prudhoe Bay. So without getting all rabid, can you describe the differences in those two places?
Well, it's hard to do it without getting rabid because this is something I'm really passionate about. In northern Alaska, you have the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is basically what the Arctic is like, untouched by humans. This has been, protected by the U.S. government. And to get up to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, you can't just drive there. We flew into Fairbanks, and then we had to take a series of tiny airplanes. And eventually, as you're going north, you have to make it over the Brooks Mountain Range, and you're heading towards the Arctic Ocean. And so you've got the wind coming off the Arctic Ocean into the face of the airplane. And this is one of the most dangerous places really in the world to fly, because the small airplanes are fighting the wind, trying not to stall. But eventually we make it over the Brooks Mountains and we land on the coastal plain, and the airplane leaves us there. And so we get to spend 5 days canoeing the Jago River all the way to the Arctic Ocean. And then once we get to the Arctic Ocean, we cut across a small section of the ocean and end up at a small island where an airplane picks us up. And then the second part of the trip, we go back to Fairbanks, we rent an automobile, and we head up the Dalton Highway going all the way up to Prudhoe Bay. And that's where the oil companies are. And both are about as far north as each other, but Prudhoe Bay is about 120 miles to the west of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And so here you get to see the difference between what the Arctic looks like untouched by man, and then you get to see what it looks like at Prudhoe Bay. And one of the things that always upsets me is you hear oil companies and you hear politicians say two things. There are two major talking points. Are one, there's a bunch of nothing up there. There's nothing up there we're going to hurt. Well, it's not a bunch of nothing. It's gorgeous up there. There's tons of animals, plant life. It's beautiful up there. But the main thing is you hear oil companies and politicians saying, if you let us drill up there, you're barely going to know we're there. We're just going to have this tiny little footprint. But once we got up to Prudhoe Bay, in fact, even before we reached Prudhoe Bay, as we're driving up this dirt road to Prudhoe Bay, in the distance, we can see this sickening yellow haze. And Prudhoe Bay puts out more air pollution than many major cities. And then we get up there, and there are oil wells and oil rigs and oil equipment as far as the eye can see. And I have pictures of this in my book. And I think this is really the main reason I wrote this book, was for this chapter, because I don't think people can really imagine what a difference 120 miles can make. Once you get to Prudhoe Bay, there's security, so you can't just drive in and explore, so you have to sign up for a tour. And the first thing they do is they take everybody and they put you in a room and they show you a video. And part of the video is talking about how we are committed to the environment. And then they walk you on to a bus, and then the bus takes you in, and you go past all these oil wells, and eventually you end up at the Arctic Ocean, and it's time for everybody to get their polar bear plunge certificate. And so a lot of people wore swimsuits underneath their clothing, and then they jump into the Arctic Ocean so they can get the polar bear certificate. And we had just spent a lot of time in the water getting wet when we were in the Arctic Refuge. We had no desire to go swimming, so my wife and I just kind of used this time just to kind of walk a little bit to the side while everybody's swimming. And as we're walking along the beach, you can see this black gunk. And I didn't taste it. I didn't smell it. So I can't say 100% sure that that was oil, but I'm pretty darn sure that was oil. And so we're watching these people as they're swimming in this stuff. And it was like, oh, good. How could somebody get in there? But, you know, they're not thinking that. And it's that whole psychological, you know, we are going to the Arctic Ocean and yada, yada, yada. And people don't realize what they just walk through to get into that water.
I thought you reined yourself in well when you were writing that chapter. You stuck to the facts, although I suppose you really wanted to editorialize more than you did.
Well, you know, everybody's guilty, including myself. I mean, I drove an automobile to Prudhoe Bay. You know, I flew up from Montana up to Fairbanks. So it's not like I don't use oil. And so it's impossible, really, for me with a straight face to say, you know, no oil ever. But the point is we need to wean ourselves off it. Everybody needs to do that. And my big issue is, if you are going to continue to drill up there and now you want to go into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and continue drilling in there, that's not progress. That's going farther and farther into this mess we have with oil.
Mm-hmm. I really like your creative chapter names, and we heard them in the introduction, but especially chapter 3. Say that name again.
It's called I Got Cottonmouth with Two Russians in the Everglades, but I swear I didn't inhale.
All right, you have to tell us why.
Well, I have a lot of fun with my chapters. I try to come up with it because the book, you know, even though we're talking about heavy environmental subjects, at least we have so far, this book is a lot of fun, and people are going to laugh through the book as well as, you know, get upset a couple times about how humans are destroying our environment. But there's fun. And the reason I was down in the Everglades, this is a trip I didn't do with my wife. It was the one trip in the book where I did it myself. And what I do primarily for a living, other than being an author, is I speak at colleges. I put on a show called Around the World in 90 Minutes, which is based on my first book. And I was booked in Ohio, and then I had a date down in Miami. But I had 5 days in between, and it really didn't make sense to fly all the way back to Montana. So I thought, okay, I'll go down to the Everglades. So I used my time in between speaking engagements to go there and went off exploring on my own. And there's this road down there. It's called the Loop Road, where it's a dirt road, and it just goes off into the Everglades, and you don't see a whole lot of people. In fact, there were times where I'd be hours without seeing anybody. And so after having this great adventure and seeing all this wonderful wildlife, from great egrets to huge alligators, I'm driving out, and a little ways down the road, I see these two men standing in the middle of the road with their smartphones taking a picture of what I assumed was a snake. And so I get up close in my car, and I park the car, and I get out, and I immediately recognize that these two men are standing around a venomous cottonmouth snake. And I have some real ethics when I'm out in the field, and one of them is you never interfere with somebody else's find. You never get in the way, give somebody a little bit of privacy. But in this case, with it being a cottonmouth snake, and I have experience with snakes, and I was watching these men, and they didn't have experience with snakes, I walked up to them and started talking to them, and I could tell right away they had an accent. I asked them where they were from, and they were from Russia. And so that's where we get the Russians in this, and the cottonmouth snake. And so the three of us have to rescue this cottonmouth snake from the road. And it's getting towards the end of the day, and traffic is picking up a little bit. So one of the Russians directs traffic around so nobody runs over the snake. And then my job is to pick up the snake and move it off the road. But I really am not comfortable picking it up with my hands. I could have done it. I have enough experience, but if I ever did that, my wife would kill me if I ended up in the hospital. So we're looking for a stick so I can kind of wedge the stick underneath the snake and then get him off the road. But could we find a stick? We couldn't find a stick anywhere. The best thing we could find is what I call in my book a muscular twig. And so it took a while to move the snake, but eventually we rescued the snake with one Russian directing traffic, another one filming the whole thing on his smartphone, and then me moving the snake off the road. And so we did our good deed. And as I say in my book, somewhere on the internet, there is a movie of our great cottonmouth rescue. And if anyone ever finds it, please send me a link. I'd love to see it.
Anybody who has connections to Russian Facebook.
Yeah.
The final pages in the book, in chapter 4, you wrote about the trip to Costa Rica. Let's just start with the end, which is you believe that if everyone visits Costa Rica, it will save our planet.
I don't know that I want everyone to visit Costa Rica. It is one of the things I talk about at the end of the book, because as a nature and a travel writer, it's a debate I go through a lot, is do I really want to tell people about these special places? Because the quickest way to ruin a special place is to send the crowds there. On the other hand, I think Costa Rica is a great example for the world. We've got a very peaceful country. Their literacy rate is almost exactly the same as the United States. Their life expectancy is about the same as the United States. And there's all sorts of different surveys that have been done on happiness values and things like that. Costa Rica is always near the top there. They are the second greenest country in the world. The United States, I believe, is number 17. And they abolished their military back in the 1940s. And it's kind of hard for us in America here with the biggest military the world has ever seen to imagine a country without a military. But you look at, you know, if you're not, and I'm not saying that the United States should get rid of its military. We do need a military. But what if we took some of that money and instead of putting it into some airplane that's not going to fly, you know, put it into, like Costa Rica is doing, putting away 25% of their land for conservation. And so anyway, you know, as far as for traveling there, I do encourage people to travel there because I think it's a great example. It is showing how a green economy can work. You know, it's kind of like here in Montana, we've got the people that don't want the wolves. Yet wolves bring in tourists. And so there's that battle. Well, should we kill the wolves or should we protect the wolves? Well, if you protect the wolves, you're going to have more and more people coming to Montana to for a chance to see the wolves or to see grizzly bears. And that brings in money to hotels and it brings in money to restaurants. And so nature can be really, really good for the economy. And I think that's the case with Costa Rica.
There were several scenes in the book that made me gasp. But the scene where you went into the old farmhouse where the bats were, and then you couldn't quite get them, and so you had Deb go in to help you in that farmhouse. My body was tense, my breathing was shallow, and I was sitting there, I'm going, it's just a book, it's just a book.
Well, good. Thank you. I'm glad I did my job as a writer. But yeah, that was kind of, it was really interesting. We were told that we could find bats at this farmhouse. And, you know, I grew up in northern Minnesota, and my grandparents were farmers. And I think about the farmhouse they had, which was a relatively big two-story farmhouse. Well, a farmhouse isn't like that in Costa Rica. It's more almost like a shed. And so we hike a couple miles into the rainforest where this abandoned farmhouse is. And the door was open and you just walk in. And there's a front room where there's a couple bats on the walls. And then you go through the next door and it's a little bit bigger room. And it is just filled with bats. You can hear the fluttering. And so the challenge was, well, how do I photograph these bats? Now, it's daytime, but even though it's daytime, in this back room, it's pitch dark.
And the bats are back there going,
yeah, and you know,
they're baring their fangs at you.
They are baring their fangs, and it, naturally so. Here's this big human being walking in, and so they've got to bare their fangs or do something. And not like they were going to attack me or anything. I wasn't worried about that.
But looked like they were.
Yeah, and there's that picture that I just love in my book of that one bat baring its fangs at me. But it was like, okay, don't come any closer. So the challenge, though, of photographing these bats was, even though I've got a pretty darn good camera, any camera needs some light to focus. And so it was a lot of experimenting. And finally, I figured out the best way to photograph the bats was to shine a flashlight on them. But you'd have to turn the flashlight off before you took the photo, because otherwise the camera's lighting mechanism wouldn't compensate for the flashlight and you'd get this washed out photo. So I tried doing it myself a couple times. I'd go in there and they'd be flying around my head. You could feel the wind in your hair. And but it was really hard to hold the camera steady with one hand and the flashlight with the other. So finally I recruited my very brave wife, Deb, and she came in there with me. And the two of us worked together and she'd shine the flashlight and I'd get the camera focused. And then I'd let her know and she'd turn the flashlight off and then I'd shoot the photo.
You married the right woman.
I did, yes.
Marty Essen lives in the Bitterroot Valley of Montana. Look for more information about him at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to past programs and our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.